This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, the history of single women in the 20th century and what it means to be a single woman today. Journalist and editor Betsy Israel has taken a look at the fortunes of single women, beginning with spinsters, unwed girls and women who worked as weavers in pre-industrial Europe, to the ways single women live today. Betsy Israel is the author of the new book, Bachelor Girl, The Secret History of Single Women in the 20th Century. She draws on as sources popular media over the years, newspapers, literature, and diary entries to record this history. And by and large, the message about unmarried women has been, there's something amiss. She can't really be happy. Listeners, join us with your thoughts, your comments this afternoon. I invite your questions. I look forward to hearing from you. Here are the telephone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Betsy Israel, has written articles and worked as a columnist for many national publications. She's written several screenplays, and she is also the author of Grown Up Fast, a true story of teenage life in suburban America. Her new book, Bachelor Girl, is published by Morrow. Once upon a time, Betsy Israel was a woman living on her own in New York City. Today, she is a married woman with two children. Betsy Israel, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. You've been married for 13 years?
Yes, incredibly enough. I have been. But I loved being a single person, and the genesis of my book was my last few years as a single woman in New York, when it began to seem increasingly difficult to be a single woman in New York, in that people couldn't understand why I was a single woman in New York. Why wasn't I married, and what were my plans, and where was I going in that bigger picture, and what was happening? And just almost virtual strangers on a daily basis when I was 26, 27, 28, just had to find out what was going on with me.
Yeah.
I had crossed some line there.
Yeah.
And, I couldn't go back from there, so I felt like I was kicked out of my single life somewhat.
Today, when you look back at that period of your life and those daily questions, what do you think about that? What do you think about that attitude toward?
Oh, I think it's horribly intrusive. Now that I've gone back and researched the whole thing for centuries and centuries, it's not in the slightest bit surprising. But at the time, I was furious. I was working then as a magazine editor, and this whole period of time coincides with the publication of that very nasty Yale-Harvard survey circa 1986, which dictated that women, as they turned 30 and got older, would have increasingly fewer and fewer chances to ever marry, to ever find anybody remotely appropriate to marry. And, you know, as an editor, I was being asked to do these kinds of what I then referred to as emotional terrorism stories, in which we scared single women into thinking that they would never get married because it sold issues. You know, so at the time I was fascinated by how you can hear lovely Manhattan in the background, up and down First Avenue. I was fascinated by how little research there was into the findings of this study, and the whole thing, of course, was later taken apart and denounced. Even the people who had organized the study agreed that it was ridiculous. But I just couldn't believe how terrifying it was to women and how it was everywhere. So I was angry on so many levels. I was annoyed just for my life. I was annoyed that I was made uncomfortable in social situations. And I felt angry as a professional that I was being asked to make these really sexist and obnoxious headlines.
Yeah. As you were writing those stories and those articles for the magazine, did you wonder, gosh, is this going to apply to me?
Of course I wondered that. I think because I'd studied women's studies in college and because I'd been very feminist in college, I didn't really believe that it applied to me. But let's put it this way. Everyone in the culture secretly believes that they will get married and that they should get married, and we all secretly know that it's for heterosexual women, it's better to have been married at least once than never to have been married at all. in the larger social scheme of things. So yes, I was a tiny bit freaked out. Not as much as some people. Some people were very, I remember a lot of massive hypochondria at around that time. A lot of women who came to believe that they had, this was the big illness of the day was chlamydia, and this was a sexually transmitted disease that had no symptoms whatsoever. You may remember this. And I can't tell you the number of otherwise intelligent, well-educated, perceptive young women I knew at the time who believed they had this horrible disease, which, of course, is very telling because when you get into the history of single women, you find out that disease has always been one of the metaphors that applies to almost all single women at all times throughout history.
Mm-hmm.
So here were all these girlfriends and acquaintances thinking that they had something secretly wrong with them, something that didn't show up. Chlamydia was the perfect disease for its time. Now I think it's perimenopause. This is the great new overwhelming disease that you can get without even knowing it when you're 34 or 35. Hey, you could be in menopause and not even know. And women, I interviewed over 100 women for the book, and they do worry about these things because this is what's out there. These are the stories. They're unavoidable. They're everywhere, on every newscast in some way or another, every news magazine and any magazine, and now on the Internet.
Yeah, so the biological clock is still playing big time.
Yes, it is, and people still use that obnoxious phrase, which I so hated.
Yeah, you heard it so many times. What did
endlessly.
You?
Endlessly.
Yeah.
I began, as I said in the book, I began to think that it was actually an organ in the body. It really was something that existed like a kidney, you know, but a diseased one.
Yeah.
But that what happened in the late 1980s and what's, you know, still goes on now has its roots in a much deeper, longer history. And that's, I was very eager to get down to it. I mean, what is it about being single? Why are so many women so happily single? So happily single, they don't even think of themselves as single. They just think of themselves as people living their lives with kids in all kinds of different situations, variations. And yet there's still this kind of stigma attached to it. It's still seen as very much an other, capital O,
yeah,
social category.
Well, it's so strange to me. I mean, it's so sad, and there's so much pathos here. I mean, single is something either we have been, or will very well be again.
Oh, absolutely. And that is, in fact, a statistical calculation that's been made by the Census Bureau and various other national organizations. I mean, all adult women, meaning women over 18, are going to be on their own for some period of time, whether it's, you know, at the beginning, in the middle, or later on when they outlive their husbands or mates. So it would be nice to think that there's a way to make single life a little more enjoyable, or to release it from this ridiculous category that it still seems to dwell in.
Yeah.
Because so many people really are perfectly happy being single. What they're not happy about are the stupid comments on the part of other people, the attitudes of their families. God forbid a younger sister should get married first. There's a great scene in Bridget Jones where she's seated at the table in the movie version, and everyone turns to her and asks, you know, what is it? She's been brought as a single specimen to this couple's only dinner party, and they ask her, what is it? Why are there so many single women in their 30s? What is this about, anyway, you know? And she says, well, it may have something to do with the fact that our bodies are covered in scales. Which is as good an answer as any.
Yeah.
But this really does go all the way back in time to the point where I've found that there is a parallel single history to the usual history that we know, or as it turns out, don't really know about women being married and women in all, as mothers, women doing all kinds of other womanly things. But there is a single track.
Yeah.
As well.
Well, once you get past that single problem and you're married, then the next question is, where are the children? It always seems to me that there's something we're worrying about, that really women should just, we shouldn't put up with that kind of stuff.
With being made to worry that we won't have our children?
Yeah, that we either, you know, we're not following the plan.
Oh, there's always a plan.
Yeah.
There are always people who deviate from it and are punished for even, if it even starts to seem as if they might deviate from it. But I think one sort of minor triumph in this area is the fact that Sylvia N. Hewlett's last book, Creating a Life, which was all about how professional women of a certain caliber would undoubtedly sacrifice their chances to be mothers. Big, big book, tons of publicity, and it failed utterly. Nobody wanted to buy it. And many 35-ish women were quoted as saying that they just did not want to read another book which told them that they were not going to have children. Mm. They didn't get on it immediately and start planning out their whole lives as if such a thing were possible. Mm. So I think increasingly women won't put up with it. But it's harder when it's inbred in your family and among your acquaintances and friends. Mm. I have a number of women I interviewed for the book, because it's both a history of how the media has perceived single women, but also how women live with those images. A number of women reported receiving what they refer to as dead calls, meaning that relatives or somebody in the family would be assigned to call them to make sure they hadn't died there on their own and there was nobody to notice, which is another of the ongoing motifs or tropes of single life as it occurs in novels and movies. The person who dies and nobody notices, except her poor, pathetic little cats. Women talk about being slipped money at family events because, well, after all, she's not married, so maybe she needs a little cash to get home. Some of these women were stockbrokers. Hugely insulting.
And there's a story of a woman in the book who she says, you know, my married friends, they can't believe I intentionally decorated my apartment and have nice cookware.
French pots. Yeah. She was very funny because it was upsetting to her married friends. Though it's subtle, it's not the case that a married friend walks in and is insulted or strange. But it's, you know, single life is supposed to be temporary, supposed to be transitory, and you're not supposed to take it seriously. But beginning in the 1970s, in the mid 70s, women started to treat single life as if it were truly a grown-up life. And there's a great quote from one woman who said, I think circa 1974, "Don't call me a swinging single. I'm an unmarried grown-up." Mm. And women, there were many, many stories about which were actually also related to the Equal Credit Opportunity Act and women being allowed to get mortgages on their own and have credit cards and things that it's hard to believe women couldn't have, but couldn't. So suddenly there were women, you know, buying houses, buying co-ops in cities and decorating. And as recently as the 1960s, that was really very unheard of.
Yeah. I've got a listener here waiting to talk with us, and I want to get to that call in just a moment. But right here, I do want to tell you this. This, I was, you know, thinking about some of these questions yesterday as I was reading your book and thinking about what we might talk about today. And I was reminded of, in the 1980s,
yes,
a friend, a reporter, bought her first home as a single woman.
Yes.
And on the record, now listen to this, on the record in the recorder's office,
she was called
spinster.
That's right. It still goes on.
Yeah. Let's talk with this listener. Line one, caller in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm very intrigued with this topic, and I have to admit I haven't read the book or heard. But anyway, here's my question.
Sure.
Can anything compensate talent, hobbies, pets, groups? And you talked about decorating. And I'll hang up and listen to what you have to say. I appreciate very much what you have to say. Thank you.
Thank you.
Did you want to...
I'm sorry, I missed the first part of the question.
I think what she was saying is,
she's going in and out.
What are women doing, single women doing in their lives, leading, how are they living their lives and making them full and you know, not needing to be married?
They're living their lives as if they're just living them. That's the best description. There is no more of this of going out by oneself. Single women have a broad range of friendships that traverse married friends, other single friends, relatives, gay friends, colleagues. I can't honestly say that at this point in time there are specific things that single women do to fill up their time as single women, because that perception among themselves is just starting it's really starting to wane a bit. But going back in time, you'll find all kinds of things that single women did, on to be somehow justifiable as people in society who weren't married. But now I think people just live, and this whole thing is really rather annoying. All of these nasty little comments and outmoded views.
Mm. Betsy Israel is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of Bachelor Girl, The Secret History of Single Women in the 20th Century. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, questions, comments, they're invited. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. So why call it a secret history?
Because I think it's unknown that single women flourished, had interesting and good lives long before the 1970s. It was very difficult, there's no question. But I felt, as I researched it, I began to feel as I should just call it the secret history of all women, because it was just astonishing to me how many young women, my research assistants, other people who read and do some comments on the manuscript, just didn't seem to know very much about basic women's history. So I called it secret because I don't think that the single life has ever really been excavated like that on a pop cultural basis. I mean, there have been academic studies and things that a general audience wouldn't be very drawn to. So it's secret because it's just unknown that working girls lived in a certain way, that, you know, early shop girls lived and carried on a certain way, that secretaries, I mean, that there were all of these different groups of functional single women, especially in cities, and with increased emphasis following every single major war that we've ever been in. I thought that their stories should be told and that their place in the culture should be commented on, and how much it, in particular, how much it scared other people, the fact that there were, you know, bachelor girls or bohemian girls or shop girls or steno girls or whoever there was that given year. The amount of terror that these poor girls, who really were poor, literally earned no money, lived in often impossible circumstances because there was no housing for single women. I mean, amazingly, it was almost, you could not find your own apartment until about 1900. So I thought that the amount of alarm incited by single women was worth looking at.
Yeah. Working conditions for these women, factories, shops, what were they like?
Oh, very difficult, very stringent. In the shops, I guess, when I say shop, I mean department store. So the shop girl is an interesting icon, and I think of them as archetypes or icons, because she, from the factory, this particular young woman would be expected to stand all day long wearing a very tight shirtwaist, which was a back buttoning that looked like a dress, but it was actually a shirt, and a long, very cinched waist skirt, and some kind of incredibly uncomfortable lace-up shoes. And they'd work for about $6 a week. They were often subjected to bosses who encouraged them to prostitute themselves for clothes so they could look nicer at their jobs. So there were a lot of horrible things. There were no facilities. Sometimes they couldn't go to the bathroom all day. they had five-minute lunch breaks. But despite all that, they would form clubs, and they had, you know, girl-to-girl associations. They had store newsletters, and they really entertained themselves, and they really saw themselves as being a group of single women together. And there was always kind of a feminist tinge to what they did. And they always tried to have fun. And people were always shocked by them. They were known to sing in their off hours, was a stinging commentary. Interestingly, a lot of upper-middle-class women were very frightened by lower-class working girls, single girls, because they saw them as potential mistresses and prostitutes, you know, which some of them were, admittedly.
Yeah.
So I would say working conditions bad, but attitude really good.
Yeah, and this was curious to me, and they were largely left out of the labor movement. They had no voice,
initially,
really.
Initially, that's true. They had to organize on their own because men did not initially think women had a place in the labor movement because they didn't think women had a place in the labor force. It was widely thought that in order to, in the aftermath of the Industrial Revolution, that to reconstitute the working class home, that women had to be in the home. So the fact that women weren't, and that such young women weren't, that daughters were out working, was very upsetting to many men. And, you know, women were so furious by their exclusion that in the earliest strikes that we read about, which go way, way back into the 1820s and 30s, they refused, striking workers, mostly in factories, refused to have men help them. They didn't want their advice. They were going to organize their own strikes.
Hmm.
For better conditions.
Well, there's a little parenthetical that you include in the book that in the labor movement, in terms of unionizing women, the only discussion there was of the male labor movement was unionizing women for prostitution.
Well, it was rather discussion of what to do about all the prostitutes.
Oh,
you know,
okay.
The prostitutes were, they weren't really concerned with unionizing the prostitutes, but rather, you know, discussing what on earth they were going to do with them because they were such a, you know, a health hazard, and they were just such a disgusting, sort of the way we look at homeless people now in so many cities. What are they doing standing around there? Yes, that is sickeningly true. It was also, you know, working girls largely, and they were always referred to as girls, were thought to be prostitutes. In fact, because prostitution came under the heading throughout the 19th century, well into the 20th, of vagrancy, if a young girl was seen standing on a street corner waiting to cross, she could get arrested. It was very shocking and upsetting that there were all these women out walking around. And many of them, the only conclusion that anybody could come to, especially because some of them were not dressed in a refined way, but rather in a rebellious way, meaning they weren't wearing hats, was to assume that they were hookers and that they should be arrested. And loitering, yeah, a lot of mothers in that period, you read many accounts of mothers who taught their daughters how not to seem loitery on the street. That's an actual adjective, loitery, so that they would keep moving. And I've often thought that the reason in old movies you see women rushing down the street so intensely in those high heels, click, 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 is because nobody was supposed to stand still on the street. It was really asking for it.
And in the early 20th century, in terms of reading material, fiction, what kinds of things were women reading that were maybe served as cautionary tales?
Oh, you name it. It served as one. Early films, romance novels, novels that had working women characters. Every now and then there'd be a novel in which a working woman character did all right because she usually got married at the end. A few novels by Sinclair Lewis, for example. This was the early age of movies, and a lot of movies had this as a theme. I guess I should backtrack and say that singleness became a kind of repertorial beat in the 19th century, and people started, reporters and other writers, began to cover this as a social phenomenon, and not a healthy or a good one, so that a lot of the early films and movie magazines and plays would have had titles like, you know, oh, the girl who couldn't help herself, the girl who didn't think, the girl who forgot, the girl who fell down. And the focus of a lot of these was drawn from melodrama and vaudeville, and it was always about a young girl who was, you know, in some way or another fell into a life of prostitution because she had chosen to go out on her own. There was even a whole period of time when there was an alleged mass criminal at large in our country, and that was the white slaver, and the white slaver was said to abduct young women in public places and sell them into prostitution. It was actually the plot of Thoroughly Modern Millie, which is once again a popular show on Broadway. But the white slaver, yes, there were some instances of this, and ultimately some laws were passed, but it became this, you know, this terrifying cultural phenomenon, much as women in the 1980s and 90s began to fear becoming bag ladies. It was something that you heard about so incessantly. And without there being much to suggest that this was indeed your fate, it was a very powerful story. And a lot of early films and novels from, say, the World War I years and slightly before had to do with white slaving.
Yeah. So these are some exhibits from the Spinster Museum.
Yeah.
which you begin the book with is a little tour of the classical Spinster Museum, and in these things that you just mentioned are all parts of what you'll find in the museum. And then you say pieces of this collection are still scattered about the culture.
Oh yes, I think the whole illness concept that we were discussing, original spinsters, women who deliberately hadn't married, it was thought that there were all kinds of things terribly wrong with them. My favorite is that they were supposed to have shrunken ovaries from lack of use. Very often, early suffrage workers or political women had eggs hurled at them, which was a symbolic gesture, as opposed to rocks. They hurled eggs to symbolize the unfertilized egg. And you still see this, you know, that there's always something wrong with the spinster character physically, or else the spinster character is crazy. And that's probably the more common, still ongoing misconception about single women. And I think Fatal Attraction is a great example of this, the 1987 movie. It's actually based on a B movie from the 1940s, and it's during the post-war era that we begin to see spinsters as rabid dogs who will kill men who don't marry them. It becomes in the New York Times. I mean, everywhere. There are many, many stories on psychological derangement, a popular word throughout the 20th century to describe symptoms of singleness, derangement. And so, spinsters could be crazy and are still sometimes perceived as being crazy or nosy or gossipy or ugly or fat. Anything that would be considered extremely afeminine and pathetic. Pathetic is the P word in all of this. Very sad.
In your research for this book and writing the book, did you find yourself at all thinking about the status of the confirmed bachelor over the course of the 20th century?
Oh, yes, and I wrote a great deal about you're referring to male bachelors.
Right.
Yes. The only time that I think men ever really had to put up with the same kinds of suspicions and questions and the same time there was ever any confusion surrounding men who weren't married came during the 1960s when, and the 1950s in fairness, because this was a time when people married at very young ages on average, and if a guy hadn't married by, say, the age of 30, he would very often be suspected of homosexuality, which was considered a form of mental illness at that time, and was officially until 1973. An interesting fact. But other than that, the confirmed bachelor has always had his own place to live, his bachelor rooms, as they were called. And still is perceived as someone who wished to take his time in making that decision. And it was perceived as a decision as opposed to his fate. Interestingly, or perhaps not so interestingly, confirmed bachelors have always had a pretty good time of it, comparatively speaking.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about single women in the mass media today. What are the current themes or stories about single women that play in the media today?
Well, I think Sex and the City has been an interesting show because it's the first time you ever have a show about single characters in which their being single doesn't seem to be the most important thing in their lives. Now, the show can be very obnoxious on many levels and also highly unreal. To single life as the Love Boat is to cruises, I live in New York City, and I can tell you that think women do not sit around all day talking about shoes, shopping, and, you know, having sex at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. It really just doesn't work out that way. But it's a wonderful, fun fantasy, and we're asked to look at these people, these characters, like them, hate them, whatever your reaction is. You know, they're entirely viable beings, and their singleness just doesn't sort of hover in the, above them as a kind of, you know, dark metaphorical storm cloud. And that really hasn't happened before. I think it's unfortunate that single women are still portrayed as so dithering and kind of stuttering and basically incapable of getting out a sentence, as is the case with Bridget Jones, and was also true somewhat of Ally McBeal. If you go back and you look at the Mary Tyler Moore Show, which started in 1970 and ran throughout the early 70s, it's really remarkable how inarticulate she was.
Yeah.
She just couldn't get out a sentence. It's upsetting. I mean, you feel like hitting the television. And I watched, and I remember loving that show, and I rewatched it. And the same thing was true of Marlo Thomas's That Girl, which had been on a few years earlier in the 1960s, where she played an actress who had her very own studio apartment in New York City, which is very exciting. And was my personal favorite growing up. But all of these women seem terribly nervous and terribly self-conscious. And in the case of Ally McBeal, you know, hallucinating.
Back to that idea of illness, I guess.
Yes, mental illness. I don't think it's just because you need a way to, it was a clever way of showing internal fantasies. I think, you know, it's very deliberate that the stresses that accompany single life are just so enormous that, you know, women start to lose it. A lot of the younger women I interviewed talked about how there was always one woman in their office who would speak out loud to the copier or to the fax machine. It's just the people who live by themselves began to seem really slightly retarded and crazy at a certain point, that they just had lived alone for so long that they now talk to themselves in loud conversational voices. I heard that over and over again.
Wow, boy.
That's a classic spinsterly trait.
Yeah, interesting. Thinking of poor Marlo Thomas and That Girl, you know, she'd get into these situations and, you know, her eyes would pop out and blink, 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 and she had all the false eyelashes on. And
she has enormous eyelashes
on. Yeah, and then
she also had a father and a boyfriend who trailed her through life.
Yeah, they were always taking care of her, and she
and
was always...
That's why Mary Tyler Moore was so radical.
Yeah.
Whatever you say about her speech patterns and the fact that she did work as a secretary in, it was 1970. But she came all on her own. You know, she showed up in this strange city, and...
she had a great apartment.
She had a great apartment.
And a great friend, Rhoda.
Well, Rhoda is a really interesting character who is kind of forgotten a little bit. And I love Rhoda, and I love Rhoda's spinoff show, which ran for a few years after that, because she was a very down-to-earth, grounded character. Now, she was in the sort of Phyllis Diller self-deprecating school of female humor. I'm fat, even though she wasn't particularly fat.
Phyllis, the married landlady.
Oh, she was a horror.
Yeah. Oh, she was just, you know, when are you girls going to get married? And Rhoda, you got to lose weight. And
well, every single girl TV show and many of the films, and there have been so many hundreds of films, fewer TV shows, but they've run since the 1950s, and they've all had the same theme. When are you going to get married? Do you think you can marry your boss? Because, of course, in these earlier shows, all the girls were secretaries. Yes, that's the question. And Mary Tyler Moore was one of the first ones who actually tried to answer it. And she couldn't usually get the answer out, as we said. But, you know, she was pretty stalwart. She was convinced that she was going to have this job, work, and live her life and not obsess solely about who it was she dated.
Mm. Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Urbana, line one.
Yeah,
good afternoon.
Hi. It's an interest. Hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
I missed the beginning. I had a thought. I, you know, get the Times every day, and Sunday Times are so interesting in the style section when they talk about recent marriages or people who are about to get married. And, you know, these are such accomplished women as well as the men, and that's one of the reasons they put them in. They're lawyers and doctors and heads of... The whole thing about expectations is so different. And then they're marrying at 32, 33, 38, And, you know, once in a while it'll say her previous marriage ended in divorce. But it's just a totally different mindset. And, you know, I know from when I go to New York, women are not obsessing about this kind of thing. When I was 24 and got married, that was on the late side.
Yes.
And I spoke, you know, 24 and a half it
was. Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. And then recently I got to know an Italian student, a civil engineering student, a graduate student, a beauty, an absolute beauty. And she has her Serbian boyfriend. And I said, is it serious? Are you thinking about marriage? Just sort of after we got to know each other. She said, no. She said, I'm much too young. She's 25 years old. You know, so it's just a totally different, you know, kind of future that people, they're not dependent on men. They're independent. People are independent now, and they're not going to settle for the second best, you know, or somebody just to get married. And like maybe mothers aren't bugging them as much either. Anyway, I think it's just a wonderful thing that's happening in the world of singleness, you know, and
oh, I agree. I do want to point out, though, that tends to be a phenomenon.
I can't hear you. What?
It tends to be a phenomenon of the urban centers of New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago. When you start to go around the country into smaller towns and cities, the marriage rate, the average, actually, the national average age of first marriage is still 24.5 years of age for women.
Right, but it's changing,
but
is the point.
Cities,
and even in these smaller cities or towns with more education, women aren't going to settle for it. They'll go into computer science or they'll move to other cities, or it's just going to have to change on television with the role models that we have. Don't you think?
Oh, yes. Well, I definitely think, which is why I would like to get rid of all of the lingering you know, silliness that surrounds our views of single women.
Right, and that's because men are really, I have to say it, are the executives of these studios, and the emphasis on sexual attractiveness and you know, kind of, well, you know all the stereotypes, so it'll change. I think it's very nice, very interesting discussion.
So much has changed so quickly, you know, from the time I was a little girl until, I mean, it's astonishing. Especially when you do a big overview like this, it's really, really astonishing to think about how much has changed.
Well, young women and girls you talk to in the course of doing
yes.
this book, what do you see in the media for them in terms of messages about single life and marriage and motherhood? And how do these young women and girls talk about it?
Well, that I found to be a little discouraging, honestly. Many of the young women who I interviewed who were under 25 or college-aged thought an awful lot about either getting married or, if not getting married, then at least in attaining a marriageable body, as I think of it. There's a huge obsession on physical appearance, huger than ever, and occurring at far younger ages, which is, I mean, I know this is reported often, this is not news, but I was just taken aback by that. I mean, the obsession with weight and eating and looking a certain way. You know, it was almost a relief to some women now, as it was 100 years ago, to declare themselves ugly and academic, because it meant that they wouldn't have, you know, the burdens of the rest of the world screaming at them.
Mm.
And I found, you know, so it, of course there were many women who were pursuing their careers and very interested in doing whatever they were going to do, and it was very complicated. Being a doctor takes up most of your 20s to train for that, you know, and the same thing can be said of being a lawyer. But at the same time, young women were much more concerned about getting married than women in their, you know, who were in their 30s.
Interesting. Let's talk with another caller.
Sure.
Listener, also in Urbana, line 2, good afternoon.
Hi, I teach women's studies at the university, and I was wondering what the name of your book was.
It's Bachelor Girl.
Bachelor Girl, okay. And I just wanted to comment, too. I'm teaching a class, actually, this semester on the evolution of marriage and sexuality in the British novel from Jane Austen.
Oh, wonderful. You should read this.
Helen Fielding. And I taught it before. One of the things that the kids really focused in on, and unfortunately I hardly get any boys in the class.
Yes.
Typically. But is the fact that, in fact, we do Pride and Prejudice and do the postmodern version, Bridget Jones at the end, that Elizabeth Bennet is ultimately a much stronger feminist than Bridget is.
Oh, yes.
That Bridget cowers under, you know, the constant tick-tock, tick-tock, you know, your biological clock is ticking away, dear, comments of her mother and her best friend. And that's, you know, I really personally see both in my students and in other women that I know, not a whole lot has changed. We give a lot of lip service to singles, as do Bridget's friends. But I think women are still humiliated and denigrated by their singleness. And I think mothers don't have such a great time of it either. So I was just wondering if you could comment on that. I'm actually next year teaching a class on knockoffs of Bridget Jones' diary collection.
Really?
There's been a slew of books that have come out in the last 8 years, and they're all about, you know, dithering women who somehow manage to float themselves into a permanent, you know, relationship. A lot of them are epistolary novels. And I think it's a phenomenon of the late 1990s and the early 21st century that we speak about women as being dynamic and having a sense of self-agency. And then the books that we buy at the bookstore are all, you know, these romance craze books about women in their early 30s who simply have to find a boyfriend or a husband.
Yes, a lot of women, a lot of interesting, smart, intelligent, career-minded women who I interviewed for the book, and just my friends in general, have found the whole Bridget Jones phenomenon kind of cute and funny and a guilty pleasure, but, you know, at the same time and primarily really offensive, that it's, in the end, the sort of ill-educated and you know, whiny and self-centered and shallow person who, you know, who attracts this phenomenal Darcy character. So, in part, I agree, although I know so many people who, you know, really aren't perfect and, you know, who really cannot attain the standards that were set out by feminists 30 years ago and who really struggle and don't really have great careers. And, you know, so I go back and forth. I think that Bridget speaks to a lot of people because there are a lot of people like her. But her shallowness is disturbing, and yes, Elizabeth Bennet is a much more interesting heroine.
Oh,
because
I like
she's a 19th century heroine.
Fascinating, but I just think the culture surrounding her is really one that ultimately denigrates single women. And
I agree.
I just think it's a real interesting phenomenon that we're still talking about this. What's your publisher? Because it sounds like I would actually want the kids to read your book for background reading.
Oh, I think they would really
get
a kick out of it. It's called Bachelor Girl, and it's published by William Morrow, HarperCollins.
Okay.
And it just came out.
And so it's out in hardback right now.
It's in hard right now.
Okay, well, I'm going to get a copy. I really enjoyed listening to the show, and I think I'm going to use it next month.
Well, I would love for people to use it in women's studies classes. You know, I couldn't even find women in their early 20s who take in women's studies, as I was saying earlier.
Really?
Yes.
I think our university, unfortunately, is not focused enough on it. My daughter goes to Brandeis, and they have a big women's studies program, although the university is tiny.
Yes.
But, I think, you know, it's picking up. I have, my class holds 36 kids, and I've had, like, you know, at every single semester I've now taught this is the third semester, 40 or more kids sign up for, and I've had to turn kids down. So,
and you don't find that there's some kind of a lesbian stigma attached to women's studies? Because that's what almost all of my younger interviewees said when I would, you know, and the people who've come up to me and said, oh, my God, this is so amazing, this is so extraordinary, and they'll be talking about the most basic stuff of what women's lives were like even 30 years ago, and you know, which I find kind of startling. And they'll say, "Did you ever take a basic class in women's history at some point?" And oh, no, it was a very gay thing.
Interesting point that you bring up. In fact, we have a faculty member who teaches a gay women's lit class in the English department, and she's really outstanding. But my specialty is actually marital, sexual, and economic rights of women in the British novel. So I think I'm probably attracting a different group of kids. I don't know. I actually was sort of hoping it would come up in the classroom.
Well, it's, yeah.
But,
well, I'm delighted to hear you say that, and I'm trying to think of which British novels. Well, I do talk a lot about The Odd Women by George Gissing.
Okay.
That's an interesting book, and... And, you know, I certainly talk a lot about many, many novels that have classical spinster characters in them. So I think would be a useful tool for you.
Yeah, it sounds great, you know, for this next class that I'm teaching, and I really appreciate you.
Well, the more women who read it, the better.
You know, I hope somebody picks you up on a major network and you get to talk about this. I think it's
Well, I did. I was on the Today Show.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, I'm not kidding. And, the book, people, yes, they loved it.
Well, I can see why you're really articulate on this as well. Good luck with it, and
I'm
going to be reading it.
Thank you for calling.
Call this afternoon. We're going to go next to another listener. Line one, caller in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, you got a little silent there. I really like all the things that I'm hearing and stuff, but what I'm also hearing, and tell me if I'm wrong, is that you're getting an attitude about those who did get married. Like the lady who called and said more women aren't settling. You see what I'm saying? Kind of taking it in the other direction. Is there something wrong with choosing that path?
There's something wrong with getting married?
Yeah.
Oh,
I'm understanding that it's amazing what single women, the attitude they've had against them through the years. But on the same token, you're kind of giving the attitude of everybody else who got married now has settled.
Oh, no, not at all. I just want it to be possible for women to live in all sorts of situations. You know, it's sort of like being prepared for all kinds of weather. I've been married for 13 years. I love being married. In fact, I think if I had to say, I would probably say I'm happier being married than I was as a single person. And I love having kids. I love being a mother. And I think it's great if it works out for you. Unfortunately, for most of the people who do get married, it doesn't work out. And then you're there by yourself again, and you have to negotiate that. And it's always a little rougher than it should be on women.
Oh, I agree.
And that's what bothers me.
Okay, well, great.
I think it's wonderful to have get married, have a great relationship. I hope it works out. It's just that there's so many other possibilities.
Oh, I agree. So that's perfect. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, Betsy Israel, author of Bachelor Girl, The Secret History of Single Women in the 20th Century. You know, thinking of single women, in living strong, whole, powerful lives, in terms of books and movies, are there some out there that pop out at you?
For me, immediately in the present?
Yeah.
It's the question that everyone asks me, and I always, end it with a big question mark.
Yeah. Well, one
we'll
that,
wait and see.
Yeah, one that, you know, this has been now several years since I've read it and seen the movie, but The Color Purple.
Certainly, yes. And I do want to just add a footnote to all of this and say that Bachelor Girl is focused largely on white middle-class women only because that's the image that most predominantly carries through in all forms of media. So I don't deal a lot with the African American single woman's experience or the Asian American single woman's experience. I mean, the book was biblical in length initially.
Yeah. I've lost track of time.
Okay.
And I'm way past time, and I know you've got to pick up the kids.
I do.
So take care. Thank you so much for joining us.
I enjoyed it.
Betsy Israel has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Her book, Bachelor Girl, The Secret History of Single Women in the 20th Century.